the show, Evan Bray. Great to have you here. During the break, I heard some cheers, some clapping happening in the hallway here at the radio station. I had to poke my head out to see what's going on. You know, maybe it's a birthday or anniversary. What it was is, so our friends at C95, our sister station in Saskatoon, they hold their radio marathon for breast cancer research in Saskatchewan every year. And they had it a couple of weeks ago. Well, what happens is, inevitably, after the radio marathon is done, a few more pledges come in. There's, you know, they reconcile all of the numbers and they see what that total is. Well, there was another a corporate pledge that came in. There were a few more individual pledges. So they came up with the new total, the grand total for the C95 Radio Marathon for Breast Cancer Research, $528,000. Wow, that's the highest in the event's history, and they've been going for 26 years. So tip of the hat to our friends at C95 and everybody that works to put that radio marathon for breast cancer research together, $528,000. That is deserving of a loud cheer that even you can hear in the control room here at the radio station. Okay, well, we are, of course, getting ready for today's budget. It's going to be delivered this afternoon, about 3 o'clock our time. We've had a number of guests on to talk about it from a variety of different perspectives and angles this morning. Now, we're going to dip into a topic that's a little more money-focused, and it's personal for individuals. But what we're going to take a look at here in this discussion is people's personal, social, financial positions. MEI just produced and published a study on social mobility, basically looking at how people can improve their economic situation relative to their parents or generations before. Where would you be today if you think about that, you know, compared to your parents? Are you the same? Are you better off? Depending on which way you went, are you worse off? What caused that? What are the factors that caused that? That is really the basis of this study. Vincent Geloso is a senior economist at MEI, which is an independent public policy think tank. He's co-author of the MEI report that we're talking about, and I'm very happy to welcome Vincent Geloso to our program. Vincent, thanks so much for taking our call.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So when I talk about social mobility, I gave a very quick introduction to what the concept of social mobility is. But I'm interested to hear you. What is your explanation of social mobility?
So I think it's important to understand that there's two types of mobility. There's what we call absolute and there's what we call relative. Absolute just asks, are you better off than your parents? It's a straightforward question. Or are you better off than yourself, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago? So it's just a question about, are you far better off? And we can give an idea of how much better off you are. But let's say I get better off 50% better relative than my parents. My income at age 30 is 50% higher than my parents at age 30. Well, if everybody's increasing also at 50%, then everybody has gone up, but no one has changed his position on the socioeconomic ladder, which brings us to relative mobility. What we want to know is there a way to predict where a person is on the income ladder by virtue of where their parents were?
Right.
Ideally, what we'd want is somebody to climb, to have a rags-to-riches story, a Horatio Alger kind of story where the person raises itself by his bootstrap, becomes an insanely rich person, but started dirt poor. We want, kind of as an ideal of a society, we want a lot of absolute mobility so that everyone gets better off. And we also want a large amount of relative mobility. That's, I think, what we, when we understand what we mean by mobility, is these are the two things we actually do care about as individuals.
Is it all measured on salary? Is that the only measure you use when you're looking at social mobility?
So it's the one that's most commonly used, but it's not the only one. There's people will look at status. Some people will look at occupation. Some people will look at educational outcomes. So if you're are doctors having kids that will also become doctors, and people who are high school dropouts also have kids that are high school dropouts. There's tons of different things that we can look at, across generation or over time, but the one that's most common, just by virtue of data availability, is income.
Is this a regular study, Vincent, that MEI does? So is this basically an annual study on social mobility?
So this is our first one. So what we're trying to do is, I'm a scholar who works a lot in that particular field. And one of the things that happens is there's a lot of debates about measurement. How do we measure this? How do we talk about this? What's important about it? But very rarely is there a ranking of the environment in which people grow up and what allows and favors mobility. And there's no effort to say, other than Alberta has more income mobility, say, than Quebec, but no one tries to say, what's the environment in those two places that promotes the outcome in the different places? And so what we do at the MEI in the first edition of our social mobility index is we try to look at what are the barriers to income mobility. Natural barriers, things that people had no control over, that they inherited just by family, by the situation of birth, or artificial barriers. School quality, the level of economic dynamism in the province, or regulations that prevent people from climbing up the ladder or discourage effort. So we try and pile everything together and give kind of an aggregate score of which provinces in Canada have an environment that is most conducive to social mobility.
Vincent Geloso is my guest, senior economist at MEI. You did a great job of answering the question that I didn't even have to ask, which is, before we dig into the details, why is this important? Why should we study this? I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate that, but I want you to keep that in mind, because as we go through the results, I am curious to know, you know, what do we learn from this? What are some of the provinces doing right? What others maybe have to do some work on? So let's talk about, what did you find in your study, Vincent?
So when you look at artificial barriers, so barriers that come about being related to the quality of choice and regulatory barriers, so are you able to train for a new type of skills if your industry goes in decline, so you can move from, say, being a plumber to becoming a construction worker? Can you move across places? So can you go to cities where there's great opportunity, and the housing supply in the cities can adjust? We look at all these artificial barriers. And in terms of artificial barriers, the winning province in Canada by a mile and a half is Alberta. Alberta scores very, very, very high. And it's followed second by British Columbia. And at the bottom, we have, I'm originally from Quebec. Quebec is the last one. It has the lowest score in terms of artificial barrier of all the Canadian provinces.
So if we look at that, I mean, obviously, being based out of Saskatchewan, I'm curious to know how Saskatchewan did. But what are some of the things, as you went through this work, that you're able to identify that Alberta, for example, is doing right to get themselves that ranking?
So Alberta does a lot of things right with regards to little business regulation, so small and medium business regulation. It's very dynamic. So in that regard, it gives ways to upward mobility through entrepreneurship that is definitely much more dynamic than other provinces. However, Alberta does one thing really bad, and I won't lie, I wasn't expecting that when we started it. There is a particular aspect of regulation that we look at called occupational licensing. So do you need a particular license to be a hairdresser or a hair braider, or do you need to have a particular license with 2,000 hours of schooling for being an HVAC operator or whatever other type of low to medium skilled job? We're not talking doctors here. We're talking occupational licensing for jobs that are well below the 90th percentile in terms of income within the population. And Alberta is the worst province in that regard. It regulates more occupations heavily than Quebec does. So in our report, we try to say, okay, what could Alberta do to have even more income mobility than it already has? And Alberta, by the way, scores really high in terms of artificial barriers. It has very few of them relative to, say, Quebec. And it does have more income mobility than Quebec, but it still could do more. And what we point out is, if Alberta just reduced occupational licensing to the Canadian average. I'm not saying remove all of it, just move to the average of the Canadian provinces. Its score, so we give a score out of 100, the score it has is 59, it would jump automatically to 64 if it had just reduced to the level of the Canadian average,
right,
the occupational licensing. If it did that, it would have a significant effect in terms of income mobility.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in the report, everyone go to IEDM.org. In our report, we have the list at the end, on the last page of the report, what is the cheapest low-hanging fruit that each province could do to create an environment that is far more conducive to income mobility over time.
Can you give us the Saskatchewan synopsis quickly?
So Saskatchewan is the middle of the pack. It's a bit behind all Ontario, but not by a lot. It's like just a little behind. The problem for Saskatchewan, so the really problematic aspect, the area where it could do the very big improvements, is on taxation. Alberta, relative to the other provinces, with respect to corporate, with regard to property taxes, with regards to personal income taxes, it could do a lot on that dimension. And with those in mind, the other one that it does very poorly is on schooling. So our measure of schooling, for example, is the standardized mathematical reading test. Saskatchewan schools score very, very low in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that would improve the quality of schooling in Saskatchewan could definitely promote income mobility in the province.
You know, when I look at this report, Vincent Geloso is my guest, senior economist at MEI. They just authored a report on social mobility. It is very much focused on and broken down by province. If you look at federal government policies, taxation, do you factor that in per province, or would that be a separate report?
So we don't factor in the federal government. The reason why is it's going to affect every province the same. So what we want to get is the policy environment that comes from provincial government, so that our target here and who we're talking to is to provincial governments. But it does apply in terms of the logic to the federal government. We want to do it in further reports in the future, but the logic is still the same. If you can deregulate certain sectors so that more entrepreneurship can happen, so that prices for certain goods and services can go down, so that people have more disposable income, which means that they have more to invest in their own skills, in their own businesses. These are things that should be done. But right now, the report is really targeted so that people who read this can then go and see their MLAs or their MPPs, or if they're in Quebec, their MNAs, given everyone has a different name for the assembly, and you can tell them, guys, do something about this. Income mobility is important. It's the thing that binds a nation together, because everyone seems to believe if we have high mobility, that what dominates in this society is merit. And so it legitimates democracy. It legitimates the process by which we make collective decisions. You need to have high social mobility to have a cohesive society. Then if this is really as important as I'm making out to be, mm-hmm. then you guys can go through the list of what we say for the different provinces, and you can start asking your legislators, do something about this. Here are the lowest hanging fruits of what you could do.
This is a fascinating topic. I mean, there's probably lots of ways, even from a social science standpoint, you could pull this apart even further. You're talking about, you know, the barriers, whether they're artificial, whether they're policy-based, that stand in the way. A lot of it could be personal as well, and you, I'm sure, could break it apart even within further demographics to understand how social mobility is impacted.
Oh, yeah. So there are things such as natural barriers. So, for example, even if you imagine two places that have the best policies in the world, the person who's born in poverty, he has a higher natural barrier than the person who is not. That's for sure something that matters. But the thing we point out in the report is that natural barriers are not something politicians can do something easily about, at least directly.
Right.
They can solve some of it indirectly. So if you generate more economic growth, less poverty in childhood, fewer natural barriers. But this is not something that you can target very directly. However, artificial barriers, these are things over which politicians have a great amount of degrees of freedom in what they can do. Mm-hmm. It's also something over which voters have a great amount of degrees of freedom over, because they can start asking politicians about this. So I think the point I would like to reemphasize, in case I didn't do it well enough the first time I said it, is the artificial barriers are the lowest hanging fruit of what we could deal with. It's educational quality, it's regulation, it's taxation, it's the amount of economic dynamism. So do we have environments where businesses can start easily, can try to innovate, can try to generate more economic activity so that people can more easily find employment, so that if people are unemployed for some reason, unemployment is less burdensome, it's shorter, the episodes of unemployment are fewer and further apart. We want environments like these, and all of this speaks to lowering artificial barriers. These are the low-hanging fruits.
Good stuff. Vincent, this has been a great chat. Thanks for joining our program.
It's a pleasure.
Vincent Geloso, senior economist at MEI. Okay, let's take a break and come back, and I want to break this apart. I'd love to hear your thoughts on social mobility, the ability to improve your economic situation in relation to where your parents were. What will our kids be able to do, our grandchildren? It's a good conversation. It's one that I'm sure people will have thoughts on. I'd love to hear yours next here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Thanks again to Vincent Geloso. He's a senior economist with MEI. Their report on social mobility, someone was asking where you can find it. It's at IEDM.org. You can find it on there. It's essentially measuring province by province the impact that each province has on social mobility. So this is the measure how you can improve your economic situation in relation to your parents, or even in relation to a decade ago. This is based on salary. It's based on your job. And it's also relative to what we're seeing elsewhere in Canada. A number of texts are coming in. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Are we in a position, whether it's provincially or federally, where we are incentivizing our next generation to have, not just the perception of, but actually have a better life from an economic standpoint? 1-877-332-8255. I suspect I know where this conversation will go. Welcome back to the show, Evan Bray. Great to have you here. You know, it's an interesting concept, this concept of social mobility. Basically, are you better off financially than your parents were? And if so, is that consistent? This is the notion of relative mobility. Is everyone essentially moved at the same pace? Or in the absolute measure that we heard our guest talk about, are you specifically better off, and what has caused that? It's an interesting conversation. And I also wonder, you know, after we hung up with Vincent, I wonder about so many different things. Is it sector specific also? So, for example, my grandparents were farmers and spent time, obviously, on the farm, thinking about my dad's parents. My dad then took over farming. I, however, did not. And so how does that factor into the movement? I know he talked about education plays a role in this, occupation, social status, the amount of money you earn, all of those things can be factors that can be measured in this social mobility talk. Are we going the right way? Are Is our generation, for example, better off than our parents were? And will we expect that our children will continue to be better than us? I worry about that. I really do wonder, and a lot of it has to do with the things that you and I talk about every day, the growing debt in our country, the impact that social and other sorts of policy development, whether it's at the provincial or I still feel that federal government policy can and does have an impact outside of, you know, if you say, okay, well, the GST is set at this level and that affects all Canadians the same. But what about some of the industry specific things that might impact a region of Canada? I'm thinking about oil and gas, for example, or mining, or use the auto sector in Ontario. It affects a specific area of Canada differently than another. So I really do wonder if the federal government, you have to be able to consider that in this overall discussion. I want to grab a couple of calls, and I also want to read some texts. I'm basically asking the question, do you feel as if you and your generation are better off than your parents were? And will this continue on? Will this be the same for your children, for your grandchildren? Let's go to Ken in Saskatoon. Thanks for calling in, Ken. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm better off, but I know that it's going to be very difficult for my sons and my grandson to be better off. And here's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons I'm better off is that my mom and dad, five boys, my dad worked, my mom didn't. She was at home, so right. She did a lot of work. Again, unidentified work within the economic system, right? However, what happened back then in the 70s is that, especially with the oil embargo, is governments went, oh, my God, we have to get energy prices down. And a lot of that, they recognized they got hit with a shock going and with the interest rates going to 21%. And the shocks being there, everybody was going, oh, we're not going to have a better life than our parents did. As it turned out, we did. However, governments now are trying to do so much. They want to put energy up to save the planet. And there's a thing here that is really insidious, and that is, it's called a sort of mating. It used to be that women tended not to make as much money as men, women would marry up, men would marry down. And that was a way of changing income levels and evening things out. Now doctors marry doctors, MBAs marry MBAs. If you're earning $140,000 as a woman, you don't want to marry somebody that's earning $50,000. So you're going to get income inequality and status, you know, just absolutely stratification, because it gets harder and harder to move up that ladder.
Mm. I thanks for the call, Ken, and I appreciate your comments. I wonder about how, you know, there's the real version of what we're talking about, this notion of social mobility, and then there's the perceived version. And I look back at how my grandparents perceived their life. They had a very humble life, but how my grandchildren, who are still very young, but when they get to the age where they're kind of comparing their life to that of their parents or grandparents or whatever, will they perceive that it's better? Because I see a couple of texts coming in saying that expectations have changed in generations. So as, you know, the younger generation comes in, their expectation of what their first home will be, their first vehicle might be, what their job will pay them, expectations have changed. The social scale, for example, again, this is from a perception standpoint, has changed. And you wonder how that has impacted this discussion. It's an interesting one for sure. I see the text here that said, I disagree with your guest that said federal policies won't have an impact or aren't being measured. Yeah, this texter basically saying exactly what I just pointed out. It impacts Alberta and Saskatchewan over the other provinces when you look at the anti-pipeline and taxation on energy and development. Those provinces that obviously rely on energy production as part of their economy and thus jobs and essentially helps everyone in the province. Yeah, that does have an impact. So I agree. I agree with this texter. The federal Liberal government has made policies that not only push us all down the scale, but has incentivized it. Liberals would rather give handouts for votes than give incentives to work and support self-sufficiency. Steve in Saskatoon, thank you for that text. You know, it's a bit of a abstract concept, this notion of social mobility and whether or not you can look at your life and say, I'm making more money, I have moved on the social ladder as compared to my parents, or as you heard my guest talk about, you could even do it as compared to your previous self 10 years ago, where I'm at now versus it's an interesting concept. You get into this whole notion of artificial barriers. And essentially, that's what the report that MEI did, is looking at the low-hanging fruit, if you will. Again, you can go to IEDM.org and you can check out on the report there through the website what they looked at, the artificial barriers. Why is Saskatchewan, for example, middle of the pack? Alberta is top of the pack when it comes to social mobility. He said, my guest said, it's got a lot to do with their very progressive and dynamic business policy development. It's got to do with taxation levels. Saskatchewan got docked marks because of our levels of education. And you look at standardized testing across Canada, our level of education is not as good as many other provinces. And when you're measuring that as one of the measures for a thing like this, then yeah, it can have an impact. It's an interesting concept. And again, thank you very much to Vincent Geloso for stopping by. Well, federal budget is going to be handed down today. It's at 3 o'clock this afternoon. We've had some great guests on that. In fact, one of the guests that we had, Ian Lee, I loved his analogy. I mean, Ian doesn't pull any punches. We've had him on the program before, and I was asking him, he pointed out that we have had a long, slow decline on productivity over the last 10 years. And, you know, he pointed out, he says, I'm not taking a swing necessarily at Justin Trudeau, but I will say, again, his point, under the last 10 years of the Trudeau government, we've seen very poor policy choices that have driven down productivity in Canada. So Ian's point was, what we need to see in this budget today is not only the stopping of this downward trend in productivity, but the reversal of it and getting that trend of productivity on the increase in Canada. I said, how do you do that? And I loved his pie analogy.
In the last 10 years, I'm not trying to pick on Trudeau. It's just that he was the prime minister and these are the decisions that were made. We focused much more on redistribution. In other words, taking the pie and redistributing it by, all kinds of social programs that we all thought were wonderful, you know, pharmacare for everybody and dental care and daycare and so forth. This does not grow the pie. This is spending the existing pie. So we're eating the existing pie. Productivity is about growing the pie or making a whole bunch of new pies. Everybody understands my analogy. You know, you make one pie in the kitchen and you're all cutting it up to eat it. But the better solution is to go and make a whole bunch of pies. Not one pie, maybe 5 or 10 pies. Because then there's more pies for everybody. And what we did for the last 10 years is we focused almost exclusively on just redistributing the pie. And saying, well, you know, you don't over there, you don't have enough of the pie. That guy over there's got too much of the pie, so we're going to take it from him to give it to the other person. And so, in fact, we put barriers in the last 10 years to prevent us from making more pies. We said, no pipelines. Oh, no, they're bad. We put, the tanker ban bill. Oh, no, we can't send oil to countries around the world or LNG. And so we put barriers in front of the growth and an investment. And so I think that the big picture takeaway tonight, when the minister stands up, we should all be watching, is he going to turn that around? We desperately need economic decisions and policies that are going to allow, encourage, facilitate businesses to grow.
That was the conversation, or part of the conversation, with Ian Lee today, in ways he sees the door open for the reversal of the trend that we're seeing with productivity in Canada. Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back. More of your thoughts and budget talk when we return here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Topics are so interrelated. We've been talking about the federal budget, which is going to be presented this afternoon. In our conversation just this last hour with Vincent Geloso, we talked about the study that was done on social mobility and how future generations are, in some cases, fearful that they won't do as well as their parents. And a lot of that's got to do with decisions made by government. I'm going to come back to this Ipsos poll I was talking about earlier that basically assesses what Canadians want to see out of the budget. The majority of them, the largest answer given was they want to see help with cost of living. And so when you look at how they've assessed this, it's the younger demographics that are worried that government is not doing enough to help them or set them up for success in the years ahead. They're worried about the deficit. They're worried about how much money government is spending. But if they were of the ones that answered this survey that supported deficit spending, so supported going into deficit through this budget, many of them said they want to see that spending go to healthcare. Interesting. Housing was up there as well. So, of course, they're looking at it through that personal lens. But as we've talked about with some of our guests today, spending money, going into debt to spend money on programming is, from a financial standpoint, not a good decision. You want to spend the money on an asset that is going to continue to make the country money. Back to Ian Lee's pie example, as opposed to an asset that is just going to be consumed and won't be actually generating revenue for the country. So I look at this poll, I look at what Canadians want, I look at expectations around social mobility and this afternoon's federal budget that will be handed down. And boy, there is lots of kind of interconnecting ideas there as well. Wab Kanoo was in the news. I don't know if you saw this last night. So the notion of, and we talked about this late in the show Friday, the Supreme Court of Canada had come down with a ruling throwing out mandatory minimum sentences for child pornography crimes. Absolute head scratcher to me. And there are a number of people that have been condemning this. Pierre Poilievre, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith, Ontario Premier Doug Ford have demanded that Ottawa overrule the decision made by the Supreme Court with the notwithstanding clause, which we know could be used to circumvent what the Supreme Court has said on this issue. Wab Kanoo took it a step further yesterday when he was talking about this decision by the Supreme Court and getting rid of these mandatory one-year minimum sentences. This is what Wab had to say.
Child sexual abuse images and video, this is like one of the worst things that anyone can do. Not only should go to prison for a long time, they should bury you under the prison. You shouldn't get protective custody. They should put you into general population, if you know what I mean.
So when he said that, put you into general population, if you know what I mean, he's basically saying, you know, vigilante justice. Let's let the other inmates take care of you. Well, I know that there are going to be people that would say, I don't disagree with that. We saw the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association of Manitoba coming out swinging at what Premier Wab Kanoo said. They said the comments are unhelpful from an elected representative and was very, very critical of his comments there. So it's going to be interesting to see where this one goes and where this lands as well. Yesterday on the Green Zone, did you catch the great conversation with Buck Martinez? I've heard Buck on the Green Zone before, but being able to get him on essentially a day or two after the Blue Jays lose that heartbreaking World Series Game 7 in extra innings, you know, Buck was really positive and talked about the phenomenal season that the Jays had.
The Blue Jays had a phenomenal season. Right now, it stings a lot, and it hurts a lot of people. But in another month or so, they'll think back and say, you know what, that was the hell of a season. And I think everybody will really look back and have a big smile on their face when they think about the summer of 2025.
Mm-hmm. Big smile for sure. Some of the best baseball. I still am having chats with people at work here about that series and how incredible that was to watch that caliber of baseball and what it's done for piquing interest, investment in baseball here in Canada. It's been absolutely phenomenal.